You're listening to Second Stories, created and produced by Second Story with me, Abigail Brocker, as your host. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia, working to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. We help homeless youth and youth in crisis step away from their first story, one often marked by abuse, hardship, and crisis, and write their own second story, full of hope and promise. Today we talk to Megan, Second Story's Vice President of Residential Services, which include our longer-term residential programs for youth and young mothers and families experiencing homelessness, as well as Second Story for Teens in Crisis, our short-term safe home for teenagers. A lot of the methods we've all been using to try to stay safe this year, social distancing, sheltering in place, working from home, and washing our hands, may seem simple and accessible, but there are a lot of assumptions tied into them. That we have the freedom to stay away from people, that we have a shelter to stay at and a home to work from, that we have access to sinks and showers at any time of the day. But what does this mean for youth and families sleeping in their cars or even on the streets? What does it mean for them when public restrooms close, as many of them have for safety reasons? And what happens to shelters designed to keep people safe, but now places where COVID-19 can spread freely and easily as people flock together in small spaces? Megan talks about some of these challenges for youth and families experiencing homelessness during the pandemic, and how Second Story has been able to safely support the youth in our programs, as well as find new opportunities to reach youth who need help. It's really overdue, I feel like, that we are having you on the podcast, Megan, because what we're talking about with you is really central to what we do at Second Story. It's been referenced and discussed since our very first season and throughout the podcast since then, which is youth homelessness and youth running away and youth in unsafe situations. And we've had your staff talk on the podcast before. To start us off, will you introduce yourself? Will you tell us how long you've been at the organization and what you do here?
I'm Megan Huebner. I'm the Vice President of Residential Services, and I started at Second Story, which was an alternative house, in 2001. And I've been in four different positions with the agency and have had the chance to work with a number of clients in various programs and all different types of situations. And it's certainly a different time right now.
Yeah. So maybe that's the first thing that we should talk about. What are some of the ways that you've seen our programs change in the past 6 months or so because of COVID-19 compared to how they were functioning before?
I think, speaking for our residential programs, the need of clients who are already in the programs has significantly increased because so many of our clients lost their jobs or had their hours significantly cut back. Youth who were enrolled in our programs who were also attending public school, who then were no longer physically attending school, lost a lot of the support that they had from teachers or other staff in those programs.
Right.
For a lot of youth who are attending school, either, you know, public high school or college, for some, there is that additional support that comes with going in person, whether it's having a social worker to talk to, teacher, coach, career counseling staff, whoever they've been connected with, and oftentimes getting both emotional support and tangible resources from. With the elimination of in-person education, a lot of those supports were lost. So in addition to, so for youth who are already sort of precariously balanced in their lives, losing their job and losing that extra support meant that at Second Story, we had to step up a lot further to support them.
Right. And what are some of the ways that we've been doing that specifically?
So certainly with tangible things, everything from food to cleaning supplies to gift cards so that whatever they need can be either dropped to them. So we do a lot of doorstep drop-offs, making sure that we're keeping staff and clients safe. We have had clients who have been diagnosed with COVID, and so making sure that we got them and their families, you know, especially those youth who are parenting small children, making sure that we got them supplies, diapers, wipes, that kind of thing, so they could keep their family unit isolated and keep others safe while getting the things that they need, because ordering delivery is really not possible for the majority of our clients. So we sort of act as delivery service and procurers of items.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing I remember us kind of talking about, especially at the beginning, that I didn't think through, was that a lot of us kind of stocked up on stuff when the grocery stores were so picked over, and we were able to order a lot of toilet paper and things like that. And for a young person who doesn't have a lot of savings and doesn't have that kind of income freedom, they just didn't have a lot of the things that they needed, which I think a lot of us just don't think about. And I know that we were able to come in through for some of that stuff as well.
Right. I mean, they had additional hurdles because, like you said, the inability to have enough resources, whether it's financial resources or space. A lot of our youth are renting rooms and shared housing with other people, and there's not the financial means or the space to stock up on items. And so, you know, we're, I think, certainly as an agency, very fortunate to be supported by the community in the way that we are. And so to have people literally drop stuff off on our doorstep and be able to turn that around and get it to our youth, it's sort of, quote, part of our job. But I know our staff felt really great when they saw, you know, items that we particularly needed come in as donations and then be able to get right out there and load up their cars and do a number of drop-offs to clients who needed it.
Yeah. And I imagine that's been an interesting adjustment for staff, because I know that we met with youth a lot in person, and there's a lot of in-person interaction that happens. And all of a sudden it was a lot more driving around and dropping stuff off, because that's just what the need was at that time. How has that all gone with adjusting to virtual meeting with clients and doing drop-offs more often and things like that?
Yeah, it varies from program to program. So
yeah.
At Second Story for Teens in Crisis, where youth are staying with us in sort of a shared living situation, the major shift there has been doing virtual family sessions so that we can limit exposure and make sure that the services that we're delivering are all essentially the same. They're just in a little bit of a different format. So fortunately, a lot of youth and young adults are really skilled at texting, and so that's been way that they've stayed in touch with case managers and housing locators, and making sure that, you know, we know what's going on. We've done virtual counseling sessions for, like I said, for families and also for individual youth. We've done virtual life skills and parenting education groups. So making sure that as much as possible, things can be kept feeling somewhat sort of regular and stable. You know, when we're thinking about groups who have had a lot of instability and upheaval in their lives, and here's sort of a nationwide instability and upheaval in many ways. And so for us to provide as much support as we can to keep things as smooth and stable as possible, I think is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, I know that two of the main ways that youth find out about our services is through a school counselor, homeless liaison or something, which is in a school, or through a shelter, which I know that youth may feel more hesitant to go to a shelter now because of social distancing concerns and things like that. How has that changed with youth who are in need, learning about the options that are available to them, if two of those main avenues they just may not be accessing as much as they were before?
It's definitely a concern. We've seen a drop in a number of calls and inquiries for all our residential programs for new clients. And I think Child Protective Services has seen the same thing. They saw a huge drop off in the number of calls because people who come in contact with people in need aren't, or they aren't in the same ways. School is obviously a big one, but even doctor's offices, people are not going in as regularly as before. And all of those different touch points that people would come in contact with to find someone who can help them or find someone who can refer them to someone who can help them just aren't happening. So we have seen, even though the need is greater, we have seen fewer people who are reaching out because there's that element of uncertainty. People don't necessarily want to enter a shared living situation right now with with people they don't know unless they have to. The people who do reach out to us have such a higher level of crisis and need because they really do have no other options.
Right. They're more desperate. Are there ways that we've been beginning to brainstorm how do we reach youth differently now, or are we still kind of in the season of recognizing the increased need and the gaps in reaching out?
Both, I think. I mean, this is not going to be a world situation that ends anytime soon.
Right.
So we are looking at sort of longer term, what shifts can we make to reach out to more youth and also just to continue to keep youth and staff as safe as possible for outreach. We are participating in more virtual activities as the agencies and the groups that we partner with have shifted to virtual types of training and support for their staff. So we normally, for example, when the counselors for all the high schools and the middle schools return to work just about this time, they usually would gather for an in-person meeting and in-service training day, and we would set up a table along with other service providers. So obviously we're not doing that this year, but instead we're sort of setting up a virtual table as they all are. So on their training website, there will be our information and links to our services and service descriptions so that hopefully staff and other programs are accessing the information that they need about referring youth to our programs. And hopefully the more youth who we stay in contact with and the more that they stay in contact with their friends, they'll be better able to sort of refer their friends to us
when
they hear about someone who's having a particularly tough time.
It's interesting too, because another episode from this season is a young woman named Ximena who did not access our services, but she found out about us later because she experienced homelessness. And now that she's stable, wanted to be able to get involved and give back. And she's donated some in-kind goods during COVID. And one of the things that she talked about when I spoke with her was that when she became homeless, it just sort of felt like there was a lot of shame in this having happened to her. And the narrative she was sort of feeding herself was, this isn't going to last very long. It's embarrassing that I'm in this situation right now. And it won't take that much longer for me to get back on my feet because of these unique circumstances that I fell into. And then she was homeless for quite a while. And I imagine that that might be happening to other youth at this point too, is thinking, well, this is just because of COVID and it's kind of embarrassing. Maybe I know that unfortunately shame can play a role for young people. And I wonder if that's part of maybe why youth aren't self-identifying, is because it seems like this is just such a unique situation and they're just going to figure it out once things get better. And then the longer it goes on that we're living this way, maybe they begin to realize that this is more of a long-term thing.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the self-identification piece is certainly huge. We've in the past have asked current clients, you know, whether they would identify as homeless, and by and large majority say no. And how they came to find out about us was through that person who, you know, whether it's a friend or a school staff person or someone they've come across, you know, knew something about them and heard something from them. Not them stepping up saying, hey, I'm homeless, but them saying, I'm really worried about what's going to happen. And so those remarks are the things that have clued them in that something's wrong, rather than someone stepping up and saying, you know, hey, I identify as homeless and I have no place to go. So I think we are going to miss out on people who really do need help and support for any number of reasons, unfortunately.
Yeah. More broadly, I guess we should probably touch on this since we haven't had you on the podcast before. For people listening who are not familiar with youth homelessness in this community, speaking even more broadly than just this moment where youth have become much more vulnerable because of COVID-19. I know when I, for example, moved to this area several years ago, I was not familiar with the fact that youth homelessness was a real issue or really existed here. And I think that there are misperceptions about this because we live in an affluent community. So for people who are unfamiliar with this situation, unfamiliar with the issue of youth homelessness in our community, can you give us just some background on the status of youth homelessness in Northern Virginia over the past several years and some of the reasons why a young person might become homeless and what that life might look for them when they do become homeless?
It's a tough topic, partially because there is such a variety of situations and faces. We do live in a very affluent county, but the county itself is very divided in terms of how that wealth is spread out. So we have both geographic and sort of socially a big distance between youth who are homeless and individuals in the county who aren't, for the most part. So I think there are sort of the stereotypes of who our kids may be, but the reality is for a lot of our homeless youth, they're youth who are working, they're youth who are trying to support themselves. The same is actually true for adults who are homeless in the community, and more than half of them are employed and working.
Wow.
It's just so hard in Fairfax County to earn a living wage for a lot of people. So you can work full time at a fast food restaurant making minimum wage. And if it's just you, there's no way you could earn enough to rent any kind of apartment, for example.
Yeah, that is just wild.
Yeah.
It's hard to comprehend.
It is. And so we have youth who are trying to cobble together a number of different jobs in order to rent a room, while also some of them trying to finish high school. And there's just not enough hours in the day. Thinking about all the challenges that they're facing, you know, financially and then socially, that's often hard. If you're not, as a teen or young adult, you're not able to do the things that you either think other peers your age are doing.
So in that kind of situation, when a young person realizes their situation is different than their peers and they're trying to work and support themselves and go to high school, where does that often spiral? Where do they, without services like Second Story or other support, where do they often end up?
It's hard. A lot of our youth who are not parents will not go to an adult homeless shelter for any number of reasons. It's a very intimidating place.
Yeah.
For the number of people who they have to serve, it's just a lot of people going back and forth at the single shelters, and they certainly provide a lot of supports and services. But for someone who's essentially still in high school, you know, they're not necessarily the same sort of level of adult that, you know,
right,
a 40-year-old is. Our youth who are parenting are more likely to enter a family shelter than the single youth. So when you think about sort of the physical need of having some place to stay, you know, some of our kids will access the adult shelter system, but many won't. There's all the other options that adults who are being challenged by homelessness might face. So in terms of trying to do what they need to get more money, whether that's doing things that might be risky in terms of legal risk or personal safety risk. And that's sort of just the housing piece. There's the need for, you know, food. There's the need for emotional support. And so, you know, all of those things can can be hard to come by, and especially if you have maybe one of those needs met. Again, because it's such a precarious balance, there's usually something that slips through the cracks. So someone might be able to pay rent for the room that they're renting 1 month, but it means that they don't have access to food, or very limited access to food that month. And so these are some really tough trade-offs that people are forced to make. Medication is another thing. Dental services. I mean, these are all things that I think people might not always think through, kind of what goes into
right.
getting a basic teeth cleaning.
Right. Without insurance.
Mm-hmm.
On that same topic of youth homelessness, but also I think tying in some of the other things that we have, as a society, have been thinking about in the past few months. The study that I know all of us at Second Story are familiar with from the University of Chicago, Chapin Hall, about homelessness and some of the risk factors for homelessness, or why certain young people might be more likely to be homeless. And the moment we're in with the Black Lives Matter movement and the energy that we're seeing to pursue racial justice, the stat about Black and African American youth being more than 80% more likely for becoming homeless, and Hispanic and other non-white youth being more than 30% more at risk. Can you speak to that at all? How we see homelessness tie in with some of these other racial justice issues and systemic inequality issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a history of inequality. And so, again, if you're already starting a number of steps back, it is much harder to get to certain levels of achievement, or even certain levels of sustainability. So, you know, our youth of color who have been struggling against so much already, you know, it is harder for them to reach a lot of the goals that other youth might, you know, be already a few steps towards. And so, you know, we certainly see that in demographics for youth who are served by our agency. If you look at the breakdown for the county as a whole, and then you look at the breakdown for youth who we serve residentially, it is a big disparity. And you know, the same thing with the COVID infection rates in our county, for example. There's a huge racial disparity there as well. And you know, you think about the situations and the jobs that put people at risk of COVID infection, for example, are historically jobs that have been some of the few that are accessible to youth and to people of color. And so that is an extra barrier.
Yeah. And I know that we could probably have an entire episode dedicated to that. And I also know that that's something that we're all still really in this moment. I want to talk about one other thing, because I know that it's maybe even more than the Black Lives Matter stuff that we're seeing in the news a lot, something that is on everyone's mind, which is virtual school. Can you talk a little bit about that and what we're expecting for virtual school this year? I know that we saw some of the challenges already at the end of last year, but we've had maybe a little bit more time to prepare because we knew it was going to be happening for even a short time before it actually is starting. What are some of your concerns or fears, or maybe on a more positive note, some of the things you're anticipating about the opportunity gap with youth learning virtually in our programs versus youth who have really supportive home environments? And what are some of the things that we are looking to do in our programs to support youth learning virtually?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges, and as there are with any situation where there are challenges, there's also a lot of opportunity. I hope that a lot has been learned from the end of last school year in terms of sort of school implementation for the fall. And we're working on getting students connected with whatever technology they might need. It is hard in shared living situations to sometimes find that focus and that quiet space that many youth need. And especially now with the fall schooling being 4 days a week and being essentially a full school day, that is a lot of uninterrupted time that we're asking youth to find.
Yeah.
And especially when you have more people at home, I mean, that's not always possible. We're working on setting up a space at Second Story for Teens in Crisis so that youth who are accessing our services there will be able to have access to their online schooling while also, you know, not interrupting, you know, if we have six youth who all need to be attending different schools at different times, you know, balancing that supervision of them being able to focus on their schoolwork.
So many families are understandably pretty nervous about their kids' virtual learning this year, but also they're able to support them from home and have, I know even some people have talked about these pods that they're creating for their kids or setting up little homeschool groups in their neighborhood with other families. What do you think, considering everything you've said, that families in Fairfax County maybe need to understand or need some insight into about the challenges of youth in the sort of position that we're seeing in our programs versus the also very challenging position that a family is in with children that they're able to support through virtual learning and creating an environment in our community and in the classroom where there's opportunity for kids in both positions?
And I think, you know, the big fear is that youth who are already in a position, a slightly or more heavily disadvantaged position, you know, things like having families who can access and afford tutors to work one-on-one with youth and keep them on track and up to speed with their schoolwork is going to result in other youth having that gap between them widen. Just thinking about sort of concrete things, for example, you know, kids' desks are sold out for 2 months, and you can pay $1,000 and have one show up on your doorstep the next day.
Wow.
But that's you know, an extreme example, but I do think the schools are working really hard to get some of those tangible resources like the laptops and, you know, some school supplies out to kids, and they have been working in terms of feeding youth. I mean, so many of our kids were getting breakfast and lunch at school and really relying on that. There's certainly a lot of efforts on the school side, and it is hard for, it's hard for everyone in different
absolutely.
Ways. I am concerned that any disparities that existed before are going to be increased by the things in effect now. I mean, special education and English as a second language, a lot of our youth fall into those categories.
Yeah,
and that is so virtual learning for special education and ESOL youth is just so challenging, no matter how many supports are in there to try and make it as engaging or relevant as possible. I mean, there are definitely chunks of youth who are going to be, unfortunately, and perhaps, you know, significantly behind after this school year. It's you know, sort of almost a no-win situation for a lot of groups.
I remember at the end of this past year, we've consistently had 100% of youth in our programs graduate from high school, which we always are really excited about because the stats about youth experiencing homelessness graduating from high school are quite poor. But we also often have several youth, both in our community-based programs and also in our residential programs, who go on to college, and we didn't this year. And I know that one of the reasons we've talked about is uncertainty about higher ed and uncertainty about being able to provide for themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that as well and some of the maybe longer-term ramifications, even if youth do well through high school but are in a position like this where they have dreams and goals they want to pursue and access to higher education is more challenging?
A lot of people are being forced to make some hard choices and to commit to school when the chances are high that you could lose your employment is just, it's a big risk for a lot of people, or not knowing in what manner you're going to be attending school, not knowing when your classes might be, the fear of going away. It's a lot of unknowns that seem to have very little positive output.
In a lot of these discussions with staff, we've just because of everything going on, we do talk a lot more about the challenges that we're seeing rather than other more exciting, encouraging things. And I trust and believe that someday we'll talk more about the encouraging things again. But to maybe end on a more hopeful note, can you talk about maybe just one thing or two things, if there are more things that have been encouraging for you during this time at Second Story, things that have made you feel more hopeful or more optimistic?
A lot of things. I think, you know, just seeing how responsive people in the community have been to our requests and our calls and our needs, to know that there are people who are able to support our youth and who are stepping up to do that. And then staff appreciate the things that they're able to do for youth more, you know, when you've kind of scrounged through everything and you find that, you know, size of shirt that they needed, or you found the work shoes they asked for, or you're able to, I mean, I think I would imagine some of us had that feeling when you were at the supermarket and you found a thing of disinfecting wipes. I mean, that ability of like, yes, I scored this thing and I'm going to be able to pass along to someone who really needs it. And I think so many clients have been so appreciative of things that they didn't necessarily demonstrate before. I mean, it's in the past, the idea that people would be excited over a bottle of hand soap is somewhat unusual, but the things that our youth were able to get in care packets and the ability to maintain their housing for youth who had been living so unstably beforehand and who came into our program and accessed our services only to have this global pandemic and upheaval, and just for them to stay stably housed and for us to be able to do that, I mean, that's a big feeling of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I concur with all of that. And I do know that when I have spoken to youth in the past few months, they are really thankful for specifically what this program has been able to do for them. I remember one young woman really pointed out how she'd had a really, really hard day. She came back and there was food there that a donor had given, but also it was coordinated by her case manager and she was able to eat with the other young women, and that was just so encouraging to her. I know that the program is really making an impact and that youth are really appreciative. So thank you for your leadership and all that you guys have been able to do. I know that it is making a difference and it's been good to talk to you and just hear some of these details. So thanks so much for giving us your time and being willing to share more about what's going on in your program.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to this season of Second Stories. If you enjoyed this season, we would be so thankful if you rated our podcast and left us a review. It has been our honor to share these stories and bits of insight about how COVID-19 has impacted some of the most vulnerable people in our communities. We hope to keep going with a fourth season next year, and you know what that means. We're looking for more Second Stories like these. If you or someone you know has a story to share, please reach out to us at communications@second-story.org. This podcast is fueled by you, your vulnerability to share, your eagerness to listen, and your momentum in spreading the word. If you're inspired by these stories like we are and want to make a difference, we invite you to join us for a virtual fundraiser this fall to support Second Story. First off, you need to know something important about this podcast. Second Story creates this podcast with our own communications team and our amazing technical producer, Franklin Bond, who believes in our mission and generously donates his services. That means that your support doesn't fund the production of this podcast. We already have that covered. Your support this year will directly help youth get through the pandemic, overcome homelessness and other crises, and write their own Second Stories. This 45-minute live-streamed virtual fundraiser will share three more stories from youth, as well as important updates from our board of directors and CEO. We hope you'll join us. You can learn more and register at second-story.org/2020-virtual-fundraiser. And you can also find the URL in the show notes. More than anything, thank you again for listening.